Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview was an absolute delight. It's with Amanda Lang, and we talked a lot about pretty much everything, actually. But mostly we talked about her new book, The Beauty of Discomfort, How What We Avoid Is What We Need. It's about change, but it's about change as a skill, if that makes any sense at all. We talk about being behind the eight ball and about how we can fall into patterns of not paying attention. We talk about head-to-toe joy. How cool is that? And about, just being engaged. And we get into things like addiction-based science and what does it mean to be sort of in the middle of something called a habitual comfort. And change is about what we choose. It's about trust. It's about choice. It's about mindset. And as Amanda is only going to be too willing to tell us, it's about finding meaning in discomfort. And I think that's a remarkable thing. You're gonna love the book. You're gonna love this conversation. Amanda also has a podcast coming up that you're gonna have to keep your eyes out for as well. Coming right up, Amanda Lang. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and my speaking. But more importantly, maybe even face-to-facelive.ca for a whole slew of new interviews in the last little while with the Toronto International Film Festival. We've got some really neat ones coming up as well that are going to be published very soon. And also rabble.ca for a whole lot more writing and podcasting about issues that matter. Coming right up, Amanda Lang talking about her new book, The Beauty of Discomfort. Welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by a very special guest today. Amanda Lang is here with us today to talk about, I would imagine, a lot of things, but in particular, her new book, The Beauty of Discomfort, How What We Avoid Is What We Need. Amanda, thanks for your time today.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, really appreciate it. This is, I love the book, by the way, and right up my alley. So how is it that we avoid what we need?
So, the big thing is we don't like change. And I say we, and I mean the species, human beings.
Right, okay.
Change.
Just not you and I, you mean? Just not the two of us?
You're a change consultant, so I hope you're good at it. Although, you can probably relate to this. I wrote this book about change, and then I had to go and say to people, don't mistake me for somebody who's better at change than you are.
I'm not.
I'm also the reason I wrote it is because I'd written a book about curiosity and how that's kind of the natural underpinning of innovation and creativity, but also of living a rich life, right?
Right.
Actually engaging and being present and asking the right questions are the secrets to not just unlocking business innovation, but also making our lives better. And there was a piece missing from that book that I only realized in the year after I wrote it, and that was even when we have the answer that we were looking for, and we went to great lengths to get it, and we did all the hard work, we don't act on it. We still let it sit there. And that's true for businesses that know they're being disrupted and they don't evolve or put a transformation plan, quote unquote, into place and then don't make it work. And it's true for us. You know, you join the gym, but then you don't go. So I started to ask, what is it about change that we hate so much? And the answer is it makes us deeply uncomfortable to varying degrees, but deeply socially, psychologically, and neurologically uncomfortable. And I thought that was kind of worth digging into just a little bit.
So in The Power of Why, by the way, you've written two books that like are taking prominent places on my bookshelf. I mean, I studied philosophy for years, so much more interested in the question in a sense than the answer. And sure. And I'm a sleight of hand magician. So, I mean, wonder, curiosity,
wow.
Mystery. I know it's ridiculous, right? So you start the book off by saying basically it's you know, how you ask the question, you know, how do we reignite that natural sense of curiosity? Do you think that is the beginning of change? Is that sort of like, was this the precursor to the beauty of discomfort in a sense?
It is. I mean, a necessary condition for change, personal or business, is awareness.
Right.
So we will do the same thing over and over. And this is where the neuroscience gets so interesting. What we think of as our habits are, our brains are literally wired for repetition. They're wired for sorting. They're wired for speed. All things that worked really well for millennia.
Right.
And they really stopped evolving. Neuroscientists will tell you are around about the agrarian age. And so linearity and speed are the things we're good at. Complexity we're not good at. We're just not naturally good at it. And that's because complexity requires us to accept the ambiguity of life. It requires us to slow down. Except that there's not just one right answer. There's many possible answers, and that the answer then changes the question you ask, right? As a philosopher, you know all this. But most of us, our neuroscience is against us from the get-go. And then you layer in a whole bunch of other kind of social norms.
Right.
That, you know, we like to operate by rote. We like to embed skills wherever possible. So some of it's physiological. Some of it's actually just how we've been trained. And we're behind the eight ball. So the first step is, what am I doing? Like, actually, literally, what am I doing in my day? How do I drive to work? What is my business? You know, how do I talk to my child? Just being awake and alert to the moment.
So, Amanda, would you say you're about the incremental change, or are you kind of about the sort of the Donald Trump-like world change?
The step change. I mean, either can come out of these moments.
Sure.
The power. So what I discovered when it's such a simple thing. It's not, the thing I say about The Power of Why is there's nothing in this book that you don't already know. Not
right.
A single thing.
Yeah,
you know
cool.
All of
it's
it.
It's good. I love it.
And I'm excited by that. And when I go talk to people about it, what I say is, I'm just reminding you to do something you did quite naturally as a child and stop doing. And it's how your brain wants to function. So when you turn it back on, the reward is immediate. It feels good. You'll be happier. And then, you know, I always think, you know, if you just think about your life, think about what you do, think about how you're behaving, the benefit, we know this, the benefit is obvious. We fall into these patterns and habits of not paying attention. So, yeah, step one is just connecting, engaging. You know, we talk about workplace engagement. We're not engaged at work, but guess what? That means we're not engaged at home either half the time. And that's a powerful change you can make for yourself.
I love this notion of falling into a pattern of not paying attention. It just
sounds—it
sounds kind of absurd in a way, but it really is sort of. I mean, it's you know. Let's quote a little philosophy here. Heidegger said, you know, you got to find the extraordinary in the ordinary. That average everydayness was anything but that. That's the stuff of life existed, right?
Oh, that's so true, right? And we, you know, we think of the moments of sadly flew a few of them for us, but when you actually have experienced head-to-toe joy, and it's almost a physical feeling, like you feel it in your fingers and your toes. And I really believe that what you're feeling is utter engagement in that moment. You're not thinking of anything
that's
else.
Good.
You're not doing anything else. You are there. And it feels good. It's our brain goes, ah, great. This is, you know, I'm all on right now, and that feels good.
Yeah, there's something. I mean, boy, can't we all? Wouldn't it be a better place to live if we could all sort of live in the moment?
And, yeah. And you would know this too from your work. We can't do that all the time. I
mean, no, of course not.
The reason our brains turn off on us is because it's exhausting to be on. And so, the evolutionary trick we've developed is we automate wherever possible. So automation is good. It makes, you know, it's why athletes get into the flow. It's all that, you know, it's why you don't have to think about your commute to work. It's not a bad thing. But next level where you go, okay, I'm automating. Let me just take a second, check in. Should I be automating right now? Is this something to automate? And make sure that you're not, because even things that have been good. So my sister's a runner, and she loves to run. It's how she gets her exercise. And she was recently given the advice that the problem with running is your body, it actually stops being as good a workout because your body has figured out how to use as few muscles as possible.
That's very funny.
Right?
Yeah, so it's fabulous.
Your core is less engaged, or your arms are, you know, whatever it is. Your body is like, okay, this is what you want me to do. Fine, I'm going to only use your quads. So she's actually going to mix it up. And that, to me, that was a great metaphor for life. You know, we will figure out how to do something with as little effort as possible, but then we're not getting the benefits we thought we were getting.
Speaking of little effort as possible, I'm going to read a quote here. So quote, and this is you, by the way, you'll recognize these words, but how do we resist the gravitational pull of comfort? One way is to simply think about comfort as a trap, not a cushion, as something that may harm you in the long run. To change, you have to turn your back on comfort and actively seek out and embrace discomfort, close quote. That's a pretty crazy statement, it seems to me, and yet you've made it. And you've made it pretty much throughout. I mean, that is your thesis, really, isn't it?
This is it, yeah. I mean, and so the way you'll note from the book that there's a fair amount on addiction science in it. And the reason for that is twofold. One is because there's such great research that ties in what we know about plasticity in the brain and neuroscience with addiction, though they're kind of leading the edge on some of that behavioral stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the other reason is I always find that the personal example resonates way much more. So if you take that example, how do you turn away from comfort? Well, what is comfort? Comfort is the extra slice of pizza. Comfort is, you know, the glass of wine or the cigarette you didn't really need. It's do things that we think are going to be key. We think they're comfortable because they're performing something for us, and it'll be different with every example. If you take a moment and you go, is that really comfortable? Do I really want that piece of pizza, or is that serving some other need? You're turning away from the kind of automatic, habitual comfort of it.
Okay.
And that's going to feel bad in the moment. In the moment, your body's going to say, yes, take it. You're hungry.
Right.
You know, have that cigarette. If you let those and you actually pay, mindfulness comes into play here. You pay attention to what you're experiencing, right? You connect at the moment. You realize, actually, the discomfort you feel in turning away is taking you to a good place. You're doing, you know, you're actually doing something that's good for you in the end. Then, so that's the beginning place, and lots of us get there. We don't really like it. If we can learn to actually see and feel viscerally that moment of discomfort as, this is the doorway to goodness, this is a doorway to a better thing, that's a powerful tool. And, you know, it's a very simple thing, and it's almost like muscle memory. But when you start to practice it, so people who have quit something will be more familiar with this than others. But you practice it where it's like, I'm feeling uncomfortable, but I know in 90 seconds I will not be craving that cigarette any longer, and then I will feel happy and proud that I didn't have one.
Well, and at that point, it's real. I mean, especially with something like an addiction like cigarettes or whatever the case might be, it really has to, it seems to me, be about that incremental
Absolutely.
Choice, right? That responsibility for that 90-second period or whatever the heck it is.
So to me, the power of that is we get that when it's about that feeling, the very powerful feeling to have a cigarette. I smoked for years when I was younger, mea culpa. So as a consequence, I quit for years too.
Right.
Until I finally did. That when you are in the middle of craving a cigarette, you think you're going to drown or die, or you cannot fight that urge. So we get that, and we get that it passes, and we're bigger than that. We don't then turn and say, okay, if you're an employee who's been asked to make a major change in your work circumstance, if in some ways that feels as bad, and you need incremental successes. You need 90 seconds of relief from that feeling and a little small victory that helps you get over it. So to me, it's just the analogy works because we understand it so well when it comes to our own cravings, and then we don't apply it to helping other people change.
Well, and you're kind of, aren't you arguing that eventually at some point that you will, I mean, let's use the phrase tipping point, or you'll pass that threshold of pain, I suppose, with regard to change, and there will actually be, you know, pleasure, joy, comfort, meaning found here.
Absolutely. I mean, and we know this from our own experiences of of being throwing ourselves into the deep end of something in life, it's exhilarating and it can be slightly addictive. In fact, in the book, you know, you meet some people who definitely are in that place where they live there. They want to feel that edge of discomfort because that's how they know they're growing and they're alive. Most of us don't have to go to the extreme on that. But I do think, you know, we, as with anything else, you know, it's a bit like the muscle burn after a great workout.
Right.
We know that that's a good thing, even though, you know, technically our bodies should be saying, why did you do this to me? We're saying, I just am getting stronger. That's what that means. It's the same thing.
So in the Power of Why, Amanda, you talk about Maria Valente, and she says that the one of the ways that she I guess just sort of approaches every day is by asking the question, what can I do better than I did yesterday? And so any insight on how to keep that sort of front and center when, you know, it seems like the world is falling apart around us, you know, the running late for a meeting, we've got a to-do list that's a mile long, flat tire, et cetera.
Yeah, I loved Maria. And, you know, one of the reasons was partly because she epitomizes what we all wish we could be as an employee, for sure, as a human being. Her attitude, her mindset is so great. And that's in the context of, you know, some tough stuff. She didn't have the easiest life. She doesn't have the easiest job. She's not a CEO. You know, it's really easy for Sheryl Sandberg to give us advice about how to be a better CEO.
Right.
It's hard for somebody who's literally working in a garment factory to be that uplifting about the meaning of her life. So where the through line for me is, and I touch on this in the Beauty of Discomfort, because it is really something any of us can do. It has to do with mindset. And in the example I use in The Beauty of Discomfort, it's around gratitude. And I think Maria might express it differently, but it's the same thing. It's perspective, it's optimism, and it's a practice. It's not, you know, we like to think some people have it and some people don't.
Right.
It's actually a choice we make every day. And you can actually exercise your gratitude muscle every day. You can set yourself as a task every morning or every night. Morning is probably better, but it doesn't matter. Write down what you're grateful for, five things you were grateful for today. And that's something as simple as that will change your level of optimism and enthusiasm for what's happening in your life. And more importantly, of course, reduce your focus and attention on the negative. So to me, that was a story that was really about employee engagement and how curiosity makes her a better employee. I mean, she was literally asking this question every day that took her to a great place. I guess the sort of evolution of my thinking on that was it's also about developing a mindset that's very intentional.
Yeah, one of the threads that certainly runs it through, I would say pretty much every interview I do, is this idea of freedom, choice, and responsibility. You know, it's about intentionality. It's about getting out of bed with a smile on our face, and that's not always easy, right?
Definitely not easy. And I think what is easy is to get lost in the negative. There's some research that shows just based on kind of, again, the way we're wired, our amygdala is a powerful part of our brain, the fight or flight part of our brain. We will pay 10 times, literally 10x, more attention to a negative thing than a positive. And evolutionarily, we understand why, right? The negative thing might kill us, positive thing, we just might miss out. We understand why, but now that we can graduate, right? The master class in this is, okay, now that we understand that, let's choose not to. Let's actually choose to focus on the positive, because our brain is geared the other way. So we actually can give ourselves a leg up to overcome our own wiring. That's what I find exciting, right? We're at this place where the wiring is what it is. We're not, you know, 10 million years from now, we may evolve and our amygdala might be the size of a grain of rice instead of an almond. I don't know. But right now, it's important, and we actually can use other parts of our brain to overcome it. That's exciting to me.
It is exciting. It seems like if we could all just get partially the way down the bridge to the other side, we're going to be okay.
I think that's right.
Well, tell me about the empathy toy and how that, I mean, it's such a great story. It sounds like such a great toy, but I ultimately love some of the insights and some of the conclusions that come out of that story.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it for multiple levels. I mean, I loved the idea of it. It fit right in with some of the, kind of the questions I was doing, even the way the developer of the toy came to it was sort of through this process of, you know, engagement, curiosity, allowing for failure. And honestly, as a parent, it really hit home. I mean, when I was talking with her and handling this boy for the first time, I had a 10-year-old at home, a 10-year-old boy who does not like to be bad at things, who would rather not do something than fail at it, which I will admit he comes by naturally. So I was really intrigued. How do you teach your child that failure is okay in yourself and others? How do you teach them to get out of their own head and see things from a different perspective? Like all the things you want as a parent. Empathy is probably top of the list.
Yeah, right? I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, perspective, empathy, wisdom, it's all very...
Yeah, crossing cultures, worldview. I mean, this is the fundamental stuff of change.
Yeah, and I witnessed firsthand how he reacted to it, and it works. It's a great toy. And by the way, it's also a fun party game. You know, next time you've got a group of adults for, you know, a weekend together. It's a pretty fun game for grown-ups, too. But it was one of those things where we can actually, again, we're thinking about how we're teaching our children. We don't have to do things the same way they've always been done because we're smart and we understand how the brain works. And I want next level for my son. I want him to do better than I was. So this was a kind of a delightful way to say, we can change this of ourselves in fun ways.
Well, I love too the way in the book you talk about the quote. I think is school is about schedules. You know, the worst thing you can do in a school is hand something in late, as if that's really that bad, right? You know,
I loved that quote.
Yeah, schools, in her opinion, the inventor of the toy, are virtually useless when it comes to teaching kids how to be more creative and innovate, therefore how to actually change or how to actually manage this everyday stuff of life.
No, it's amazing. So Ilana Benari, who's the founder of this company, is clearly ahead of her time. So she's young, but she's probably, I'm going to guess, like 31 now. And she was, like so many people at school, out of place. You know, those kids who are asking the right questions or are questioning the questions,
right.
That's the one that gets them in trouble.
Yeah,
right?
That's awesome.
Why is that the question?
That's right.
Boy, that gets them in trouble. So ahead of her time, didn't fit in. The thing I find so fascinating is, you know, there's actually new research that the brains of younger children are different than our brains. But they are changing a little bit. They're able to do things because of their exposure to new technologies and, you know, just their way of existing with each other in the world. So I think she's really getting at something really cool, which is our whole scheduled, you know, the manager's in charge kind of linear top-down existence. It's not going to work for these kids. So we had better figure it out because they're coming crashing into our workplaces. And our expectation that they're going to fit to us is probably going to cause some damage to us, not them.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a meaning in a second, but is there a way you can sort of draw a thread, and I mean, I know it exists, between Tristan, Dave Love, and the three-point shot? Is that a fair question? Can you give us the thread there?
Well, I think so. So Tristan Thompson, Canadian basketball player for Cleveland Cavaliers, did something no NBA player has ever done in the history of time, and that is change his shooting hand mid-career.
Such a great story.
So terrifying. Change that's thrust upon us is hard enough. Change we choose is really hard. Going from great to greater, good to better, that's good enough is often good enough for a reason. This guy had just signed a big contract. But he could perform better. And the key reason for that is his great strength on the court is not shooting, was never going to be shooting. He's never going to be a Steph Curry. But what he is a great defensive rebounder. He can get the ball back in his teammates' hands. So he's very useful on the court. And what they were finding was opposing teams would know that if they fouled him late in the game when the points mattered, he may not get the foul shot. So he'd get pulled off the court by his own team because he was a liability. So to become a better teammate, to better be able to perform for his team late in games, Tristan Thompson needed to make this big change. And to do it, he turned to this Canadian shooting coach named Dave Love. And love has a very specific approach, which seemed really relevant. It's built on trust, first of all. When you're asking somebody to make a big change, trust is a massive part of that. And you know that with people close to you, but with employees, it's something that often gets lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
If they don't actually believe you have their interest in heart, they're not going to do
that. Why are you directing me this way? If they don't,
and you're scaring me.
Yeah, that's right. Sure.
But the other piece of it that is actually a strategy for change that I think is useful is a really methodical approach. So what Dave Love does is he breaks down the shot into the increment pieces. So I went and actually had a session with him, and he was showing me how to shoot a basketball.
Fun.
It was fun. And I mean, I can't shoot a basketball to save my life, but the positioning of your index finger on the ball and the positioning of your middle finger are critically important. Now, that may sound obvious, but lots of kids who are playing ball really well picked up a ball when they were, you know, five, and nobody ever really said, if your middle finger is fractionally to one side or the other, this is what's going to happen.
Right.
So he breaks down the shot, but with the wrong hand. And so he and Tristan were able to get through the really hard psychological leap of, what the heck am I doing? Because if this fails, what have I just done?
Right.
I've signed a contract. I'm a successful ball player. So, and that also allowed him to reinforce the trust, which is, you know, we're taking this in small steps. There's going to be small wins along the way. But you're going to have to pay attention to the change as it's happening. So the methodical goes with a little bit of focus, of mindfulness.
I just so love it on so many levels. You've got coaching. You've got the willingness. You got left hand to right hand. You've got three-point shot. I mean, what a beautiful metaphor that is.
No, I loved it, too. And
it's just
I'll tell you
genius.
One thing that's also great about it is he will tell you that there's a point in his coaching with these kids. And I say kids because they are really young men.
Sure.
Where they've got it, and he said, that's the most dangerous point of all. They've got it. And he has to say, no, you don't. You're just you're on the ladder, but
right.
if you think you've got it right now, you will go back to your old ways in a heartbeat. So that's that for, you know, when we're changing, that's a big part of the change cycle, right, is staying in the change. It's not like it's not binary. You don't change and, you know, you don't quit smoking and stay quit. You quit smoking and you quit every day.
Well, I think that's a really important lesson about the beauty of discomfort is that this is going to take some time, folks. There's commitment here. It's, you know, and what about the community around you, right?
That's right.
Where are you drawing support from? Where are you recharging?
I think that's right. I mean, I hope the two messages, I mean, from Power of Why and Beauty of Discomfort, the thing to me that resonated for me, and I hope does for others, is this isn't hard stuff. It's actually fun stuff.
Right.
You may not
be
thinking about it, and it may feel uncomfortable because it's new and it runs counter to your habits. But when you do it, the payoff is genuine. It's immediate. So curiosity and engagement are just instant payoffs. Even if you do it, you know, once a week, you know, it doesn't matter how little of that you do. It's better for you than not doing it. And then just using this, just the uncomfortable reaction you get to change as a flag, a little mental flag to say, oh, I'm in that zone. Now I should be paying attention. What should I be doing?
Well, wouldn't it be interesting if we could sort of, I hate the phrase rewire because it's almost too deterministic in a way, but if we couldn't get to a place where if you're in that zone, you go, oh, this is actually going to lead me to a good place rather than say, this is uncomfortable or this is causing me.
I must say I'm a big believer that you can 100% do that. And I do think it's interesting. I don't know where you are on meditation and, you know, but there's a lot of growing body of research that we can rewire, right?
Yeah,
that we actually can change our neural pathways, which is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
So,
And I had a friend who for many years, just you are who you are. You know, you're not going to change, you know, to the point, you know, you just can't teach old dogs new tricks, right? Period.
The whole Carol Dweck mindset research, right? There's oodles of research now that shows mindset does make a difference, the fixed versus open.
Right.
But you don't have to, it's not preordained. You can change. If you ask yourself, am I a pessimistic person? And the sad answer that comes back is yes. don't accept that. You can get optimistic.
Sure.
Go do some research, do some gratitude work. We can totally change. It does takes effort. But
that's okay. So far, that's my favorite line. Do some gratitude work. Sounds like a T-shirt. We could both make a lot of money off of that, I think. Tell me.
I think you might be right.
Tell me about, and we're sadly going to have to wrap this up soon. I hope we can do a part two down the road. But how do you, you talk about finding meaning that justifies the discomfort, and you have examples of that. And I think the whole book, frankly, is an example of that. But could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to. Sometimes the discomfort, the change we're adapting to, is not change we choose. It is something that feels very external. Now, we often play a role, of course, maybe bigger than we were imagining. But it feels like something that's happening to us.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, how do we...
Almost circumstantial, like a divorce, for instance? Could that...
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. Or being fired.
Right.
Or your house burns down.
Sure.
Or
yep.
The example I used, and it's intentionally an extreme example, was Meher Harar. You know, this Canadian man who,
yep.
he, to this day, if I say Meher Harar, some proportion of people think, oh, that's the terrorist.
It's a crazy story. Crazy story.
He is as blameless a human being as you can find. But his name, the short story, he was detained illegally by U.S. authorities, but on Canadian authority information, shipped back to Syria, tortured for 2 years, eventually released, and then fought to clear his name. And then eventually a huge commission cleared him 100%. He had done nothing wrong. I mean, the whole thing was awful. And yet, he lives with not just the scars of torture, not just the lost time with his life and his family, but also the knowledge that his reputation is forever tarnished,
right.
Forever. And when I met him, he's this kind of peaceful, gentle soul. And I said, how on earth are you not angry? We have is that.
Mm.
And the answer for him was, there was a meaning in all of it. The meaning was rendition, this practice by which U.S. authorities ship people back to countries without due process, knowing they're going to be tortured, was shut down. And he said if one person, i.e. him, had to go through something to make sure nobody else did, well, that's probably worthwhile.
Right.
And he was able to find a reason this horrible thing had happened. And I thought, God, if he can do that, surely to goodness we can find a meaning in the things that we go through, which are much less dramatic, although, you know, can be very painful.
So good. It's breaking my heart that we got to wrap this up in a couple minutes. Can I read another quote? Is that okay
with
you? Yeah. Being alert, and this is so fascinating to me. For you, change is a skill.
Yeah.
It's something that can be honed. It's something that can be developed. It's clearly is there a mentorship program on this? Is there an apprenticeship program on this? I got to do 1,200 hours on change. Maybe is that what we're talking about here?